Presents the News of the World on Wednesday, May 20th. Once again, Columbia's correspondents across the Atlantic and the Pacific are ready to bring you direct reports by International Shortwave Radio. This morning, we shall first attempt to call in Australia and then bring you the news direct from London and Washington. In addition, Harry Marble will report on developments not covered in our direct pickup. But first, here are this morning's highlights. The RAF made its first really large-scale attack since May 8th last night. Hundreds of British bombers blasted the submarine base of Saint-Nazaire and the industrial city of Mannheim on the Rhine. There was only reconnaissance activity north of Australia, but in southern China, there's a big battle underway on the Yunnan-Thailand border. And now, Harry Marble. In just a moment, we'll cross the Pacific for a direct report from Australia. But first, here's the news from Russia. Moscow says that fighting continues on the Kerch Peninsula and that the main body of Marshal Timoshenko's troops are still plowing straight ahead toward Kharkov. The Germans have launched a counterattack 80 miles southwest of Kharkov, and a British military commentator said this morning that if this Nazi drive toward Izium and Barvinkova reaches those cities, it would offer a serious threat to the whole Russian offensive. A correspondent of the Soviet newspaper Izvestia declares that the Nazi high command is using boys, cripples, and even Romanians to try to slow down the Russian drive. Our first report from overseas this morning comes from the Southwest Pacific. After a brief pause, we take you to Australia.
CBS Australia, William J. Dunn reporting. The man and air activity to the north of Australia, reported in today's official communique from Southwest Pacific Area Headquarters, is particularly interesting because it emphasizes the trend in that vicinity, which, since the Battle of the Coral Sea, has been toward gradual acceleration. Only once before, since the repulse of the enemy in the Louisiana area, has there been a day with no outstanding air activity reported for either side. In marked contrast, the jets from Fort Moresby, particularly, have been increasing in intensity over a period of 2 weeks, reaching a climax on Monday when 49 enemy bombers and fighters staged an ineffective raid on Allied aerodrome installations. This was the largest force to strike in an Allied base on Australian soil since the February 19th raid on Fort Diamond, in which 72 enemy planes participated. The attention paid Fort Moresby in recent weeks, and particularly since the Coral Sea battle, is proving up of the headache this Allied base has become to the enemy. Competent observers out here believe the future Japanese operations against Fort Moresby may be regarded as a barometer of enemy intentions. The Australian government is making a determined effort to awaken the people of this country to the ever-present possibility of anti-air raid. Today, Robert Simpson, Minister of National Emergency Service, issued another warning. I feel it is my duty to emphasize that the danger of attack was never so great, he said. And the minister also warned that Australians, who thought nothing was likely to happen because of the Allied success in the Coral Sea, were failing to appreciate the situation. Old-timers in the American Army Air Corps here in Australia are leading concerted cheers tonight for Brigadier General James A. Doolittle and his air fleet, which staged the attack on Tokyo. One grain colonel, who has known Doolittle for 20 years, exclaimed, "Good heavens, I don't know why I didn't see the hand of Jimmy Doolittle in that attack from the very first. We'd had Doolittle written all over it." The news of Doolittle unleashed a flood of Doolittle legends, which any old-timer in aviation, military or civil, can recite for the hour. 2 months ago, I was talking about Doolittle to a couple of correspondents of the Masson's Hotel in Batavia when Harold Barry joined us. Barry, who flew around the world with Barry Post, and now a group captain in the Royal Australian Air Force. As he sat down, I asked him a carefully worded question. "Harold, which flyer, in your opinion, combines to the greatest degree the qualities of unpredictability with a complete mastery of his profession?" And he never hesitated. "Why, Jimmy Doolittle, of course. There's no competition." And you can check that opinion with any old-timer in the flying business. Any fellow who could fly solo across the Andes with both legs in a plaster cast would think little of a long-distance bombing mission. This is William J. Dunn in Australia, returning to CBS in New York.
Next, across the Atlantic to the British capital. We take you now to London.
CBS London, Bob Trout reporting. London knew Royal Air Force bombers were out in force last night, but it was only this afternoon that we found out where they went. Target for last night was the German city of Mannheim, one of Europe's largest ports, and the German U-boat base at Saint-Nazaire on the French Atlantic coast. And British fighters attacked airfields in France and Holland. 12 British bombers and 2 fighters missing. Enemy planes made a short attack on a town in northeast England. London's military circle said today that the Russian advance on the Kharkov area is continuing, although more slowly. That German counteroffensive coming up from the south is thrust against the most tender spot of the Russian front in that sector. We don't know much about this German counterattack yet. The Russians have mentioned it once in a communique. The Germans have said nothing about it. The Germans are claiming all sorts of things on the Kerch Peninsula, including the capture of nearly 150,000 Russian prisoners. And, put together with other German claims, it is pointed out in London that this would mean the Russians used 250,000 men on the Kerch Peninsula, which is just about a physical impossibility. Yesterday's London evening newspapers headlined Kharkov Burning, a report which reached London from America. But London knows no more about this report than about those two other American reports. One, that the Russians had started a great drive all along the Eastern Front from Leningrad south, and that the Germans had started their big offensive with 2 million men. The House of Commons war debate went into its second day today after question time. Sir Stafford Cripps, who is leader of the House, as well as Lord Privy Seal, announced that it will not be possible for the Prime Minister to take part in the debate. A leader of the House was appointed last March for this purpose. It's the government's opinion that the debate should be conducted in the ordinary way, and the Prime Minister has made a recent statement on the war and feels there's nothing he can add to it at present, said Sir Stafford. Leslie Hoare-Bolitia was today's first speaker. He wanted to know the basis for the new optimism and said, "I do not think the challenge has diminished in its seriousness." You've heard about that request the Admiralty made on the British home radio last Sunday for snapshots taken in any part of the world, which might, in the background, show some detail of military value. Now the Admiralty says it received 7,000 replies within 24 hours. One of the earliest from a man who has a collection of 4,000 photographs. Some of them may help on the next commando raid. The coming of spring has not taken from London its air of a city at war. But spring has changed the face of this biggest city in the world. The country has invaded the city and captured the parks sprinkled so liberally through London. An American like me, used to the grim steel and stone skyscrapers of America's cities, is always surprised to turn a busy London corner and find a square banked with lilacs, golden laburnum, and pink and white hawthorn trees. Yesterday, on a crowded street, I saw a wild duck paddling around one of those emergency water pools built in the basements of houses that were there before the bombs came. A few blocks farther, on the edge of a park, I came upon a group of soldiers working a stirrup pump, one of those pumps used to spray water from a bucket on incendiaries. There were no incendiaries yesterday. The soldiers were watering the tulips. This is Bob Trout in London, returning you to CBS in New York.
For the latest developments in our own nation's capital, we take you now to Washington.
CBS Washington, John Purcell reporting. Still of paramount interest in this capital is General Jimmy Doolittle's account of the air raid last month on the Japanese mainland. The big question now is, when are we going to do it again? Well, that's a question that the Japs in particular would be like to be able to answer. And also, just where did the American bombers come from? There's been too much loose-tongue talk here in Washington about American military affairs. President Roosevelt, during a recent press conference, warned against incautious speech among officials. And leakage of vital military information has bedeviled military leaders planning the war strategy. But the secret of Shangri-La, that mythical air base from which the bombers operated, has been a closely guarded one. Outside of the 80 airmen who participated in the raid, only a few high-ranking officials here know the details. Just where the never-never land of Shangri-La might be is a question that is posing a problem for German mapmakers. The president's quip about this fictional locality is being taken seriously by Hitler's masterminds. In a broadcast last night, the Germans reported, and I quote, Doolittle had carried out the attack against Japan from the air base Shangri-La, which was not otherwise described by Roosevelt. Several interesting points are gleaned from General Doolittle's account of the raid. The Japanese must have known that there was a good possibility of an aerial attack against the mainland by long-range bombers. Yet their preparations for defense were woefully inadequate. Not one American bomber was shot down. The general also revealed that the heavier bombers were able to outrace Jap pursuit planes except the Zero type. Most of their planes are copies of models developed by other nations. And it's encouraging to know that the imitative traits of Japanese craftsmen are seldom superior to original methods. As a matter of fact, the Jap Zero fighters, while maneuverable and fast, has sacrificed armor and heavier guns to speed up its performance. It may be significant that the Japanese pilots opposing the American airmen were inexperienced and lacking in aggression. Previous reports from American pilots indicated that enemy airmen operating in the Battle of the Indies were capable fighters. It would seem that if the Japs had enough experienced men, they would keep a goodly proportion at home to protect their vital war industries. A special Senate committee will meet today to probe the possibility of using inland waterways to transport oil to the East Coast. With warm weather, the problem of getting enough fuel oil to seaboard homes is not acute, but it may reach a crisis in the fall. That was apparent from the remarks of Robert Allen, an official of the Petroleum Coordinator's Office. He informed the House committee yesterday that the most strenuous efforts would be required for the 1.25 million homes heated by oil in the eastern seaboard states to keep warm next winter. And all indications now point to the likelihood of nationwide gasoline rationing by July 1st. The Office of Defense Transportation is working on plans now. Officials here say rationing is necessary, even in oil-producing areas, in order to conserve passenger car tires. This is John Purcell in Washington, returning you to CBS in New York.
And here are today's reports from behind the enemy lines in Germany and the occupied countries of Europe. Yugoslav sources report that the Germans have stopped using Bulgarian and Romanian troops against General Mihailovich's Army of Freedom in Yugoslavia. Too many of the Romanians and Bulgars were deserting to fight against the Axis. United Nations sources report this morning that the Germans have shot 15 Belgian and 5 French patriots for sabotage and are now preparing to incorporate Holland into Germany as a province to be called Niedermark. Edwin Schaik, one of the American reporters who had left Germany in the exchange of Axis and American nationals, said today that Hitler is facing 5 serious production bottlenecks: the shortage of materials, of manpower, of transportation, of electric power, and the ever-growing threat of sabotage. And another reporter, Alvin Steinkopf, speaks of other shortages. For instance, shoelaces. There are no spares. Sewing tape is too urgently needed for other purposes. Old fishing lines may work, but look bad. Wrapping cord is no good because it's made of paper and won't stand up. Hitler hasn't solved the shoelace problem. And here are today's reports from Free China. A heavy downpour, which may mark the start of Yunnan's notorious rainy season, drenched the southwest border region of China today. The Chinese have looked forward to the rainy season as a new ally, which would hamper Japanese operations by washing out roads, flooding rivers, and spreading malaria. Chungking says that crack Chinese demolition squads are helping the weatherman. They've blown up bridges, dynamited railroads, and blasted highways. And as the rains came today, crack Chinese troops were massed along the Burma Road and at other strategic points of Yunnan, and preparations were made to strengthen Chinese defenses fronting the border of Indochina.